Welcome to episode 8 of the Strongest Steel podcast. I want to just start by acknowledging that here in Brett's office, we are on the traditional unceded and stolen territory of the Coast Salish people, in particular the Squamish, Musqueam, and Tsleil-Waututh nations. And I just want to shout out again to the work we're doing as the steelworkers, as an organization around reconciliation. We have the Unionism on Turtle Island course that would encourage local unions and area councils around the district to participate in. And we have our great Indigenous Engagement Coordinator, Julia McKay, if you want to reach out and have some conversations about what we can do as an organization, as locals, or as individuals to work towards reconciliation with Indigenous peoples. I'm excited about our podcast today. We're going to focus on health and safety, and we have some great guests to do that. So with me here, again, in Brett's office, I guess, shout out, first of all, thanks to Brett. Brett does a lot of the work to get this going. And of course, always a shout out to Tyler Christensen, who's our tech guy, who does a wonderful job with the podcast. We're getting better and better each time. You might notice new microphones and fancier headphones and things like that. So we're picking things up with the podcast. So thanks to those guys. And our great guests in here with me. I've got on my far left is Ed Kent, our health, safety, and environment coordinator for District 3. Say hi, Ed.
Hello. Hi, everyone.
And we have Michelle Laurie, who is a SOAR activist now for us, but a retired staff rep and a member of the board of directors of WorkSafe BC and a longtime health and safety activist in the labor movement. So say hi, Michelle.
Hi, everybody.
Okay. You can say more than just hi, you know, but it's okay. We'll just go with that for now. And then online, we have Sylvia Boyce, who's our national health and safety coordinator. Say hi, Sylvia.
Hi, everyone. I'm happy to join you today to talk about health and safety.
Great. And then we also have a great guest, which I'm really excited about, John Perquin, who is also retired, was the assistant to the International Secretary Treasurer for a long time. And then I don't know all the rest of John's very long bio, but he can tell you a bit more, but comes out of District 6 originally in Ontario. So John, say hi.
Hello, everybody. It's really a pleasure to be on with you today and to be able to talk about health and safety. As Scott said, before I went to Pittsburgh, I had a very strong health and safety background and workers' compensation advocacy as well. So, and I started in Elliott Lake, which is what I'd like to focus on with you.
Awesome.
Today.
That's great. Yeah. So there's a bunch of stuff this year, anniversaries of things. And as usual, the day of mourning on April 28th. And so that's really what we wanted to talk a lot about and, you know, really anything health and safety in the union. So, you know, maybe, I don't know, we can just kind of open it up and maybe talk a little bit about the day of mourning, because that is coming up later in April, like I said, on April 28th. And so, you know, just for folks, you know, why is April 28th important to all of us? And if there's anything in particular this year that we're talking about, I guess in particular, Ed and Sylvia around the day of mourning, but anyone can jump in.
Well, yeah, it's a really tough day. You know, it's the recognition that workers have died, you know, over the past year. You know, for myself, April 28th, you know, I've got to think about all the people that I've known over the years that have turned out for these events, and the families and friends on that of people that have lost their lives on the job. In my workplace, where I worked in Quesnel, we actually had two fatalities in my mill. And you know, that day comes by, and it's a tough day because you're thinking about all those people that you've lost. So yeah, it is a tough day.
Yeah, it's you know, you think about your career when you're old and you have a new career as an old person. But I started in mining and knew nothing. I was so young and so stupid. And I think about those days, and I got involved in health and safety very early on with mine rescue and with doing first aid and all of that. But I still didn't understand. And I remember the deaths and the injuries, and you'd see that stuff happen and you'd think, why aren't we getting better at this? And I, being on the board now, I feel I have this incredible responsibility, and I really am pleased to be on the board of WorkSafe BC or WCB. But it just seems so frustrating that you cannot fix things fast enough. And every year we still lose workers, and last year was a high number, and we don't have the totals yet for this year. But it's not the way it should be, and it, you know, we lose as many now. Or more, actually, I think, to exposures to various things, and asbestos being a big one, but also wood dust and concrete dust and silica and all of those exposures that are taking people out in the years when they should be able to enjoy the fruits of their labor. And we have not, we can't go backwards and protect people 30 years ago. And that's a tragedy.
No, but it is important that we recognize this day, because not only do we remember those who have been injured and died because of the workplace in the past, but we recommit ourselves to fighting to protect those who are in the workplace today, the young workers especially, who are exposed beyond their knowledge and awareness in many cases. I remember when I was back in Ontario doing the health and safety thing that Sylvia does now, we had started a young workers awareness program because so many of them we found were being injured. Some of them, you know, within hours of starting the job, they'd never received any amounts of training safety whatsoever. So this is a day when we urge everybody to think about health and safety in their workplace. And it's every single workplace that has some kind of risk attached to it that people need to be aware of.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up, John, because the National Day of Mourning, which we all know we celebrate on April 28th, but usually it could be also celebrated a few days before that, or a day after, depending on the day that it falls. But it's so important to not only remember and honor the lives lost or those that are seriously injured, living with permanent impairments or occupational disease, but it's important for us as a union and everyone in the communities across the country to come together collectively and for us to renew our commitment to make health and safety in the workplace a priority and do everything we can to prevent further illnesses and injuries. So you'll still see many ceremonies across the country. Wreaths might be laid, candles could be laid. There could be speeches that are really important to hear what's happening in each respective community across the country and how fatalities or critical injuries have impacted the communities and what that has done to the families, those that are left behind. And I think that one of the big things about Day of Mourning is that we always have to remember to do what we can and always make health and safety a priority in the workplace and attend these ceremonies and events if you can. Volunteer to speak. Us from the national office perspective, we've always got a theme of some sort. We're working on that now, and we want to tie it into the 20th anniversary of the Westray law being enacted. And we also want to tie it into the fact that it's been 32 years since the Westray disaster. And when we just look at statistics alone, on average, there's approximately 1,000 workers that die each year. And those are just deaths that are accepted and recognized by the workers' compensation boards. There's many that go unrecognized, or they're not counted in the statistics. And occupational disease is a significant number, that there's thousands upon thousands of deaths as a result of exposures, like Michelle had mentioned, and, you know, John had spoke about our Young Workers Program. That program is really important in going into the schools, educating the young people on their rights to know their basic health and safety facts that they need to know. And the importance of training, proper training, is so crucial. And not only just for our young workers, but it's also for new workers to this country, new workers to the workplace. So there's a lot to really focus on and recommit to make the workplace safer when we talk about day of mourning.
Yeah. And I just want to, I want to come back to, obviously, to Westray and to the anniversaries but I wanted to come back to two things. And one was, something that John said about every workplace. And I think we're prone to thinking that, mines are dangerous and logging's dangerous and some of our industrial workplaces are dangerous, and that's where we need to focus our attention. But, you know, like I know in a lot across Western Canada, among the most injuries, workplace injuries every year in healthcare, there's serious health and safety considerations in, believe it or not, in Starbucks stores, when, the workers that we're organizing in retail stores have significant health and safety concerns, physical, but also to knowing about chemicals and lifting things. And there's a whole bunch of things that, you would think, not to mention violence in the community or in and around where some of the stores are and the folks that are coming in that are harassing and things like that. And so I just wanted to, just touch on that and just see if anyone had any other comments on, not typical things. We think of, we think of mining, we think of forestry as very dangerous, but the
we
other
do,
industries.
And yet we tend to create better and tougher regulations, not perfect for sure, but those are the areas that we focus on. And then those newer industries, or as Sylvia mentioned, the places where new workers are coming in, they don't get the focus until something happens, and that's a problem. You know, we've really been trying here in BC to raise the focus of workplace safety on being what we're calling worker-centric. And it sounds just like language, but it means a whole lot of things about workers actually being part of the discussion and part of the process. And you think back to when you first started, when I first started working, you just needed to achieve and you needed to make sure that you managed the work. And I would say, I don't want to turn this into a gender issue, but definitely for a woman working in a male occupation, as I did, you want to make sure you don't stand out as weak. So you just do stuff and you just do what you need to do. And you don't think about your personal protection, because when you're 20, you think you're invisible. And it is, or
invincible.
Yeah. When you're 20, you think you're invincible. And
sometimes invisible.
Maybe and sometimes invisible. But you're trying not to be invisible. You're trying very hard to be visible as someone who's competent. And you hurt yourself. One of the things that I really hope that we start to get better at is, because we're union members, what we're good at is looking out for each other. And taking on that new worker in the workplace, or the young worker, or that unfamiliar worker, and making sure they know who the rep is. We have found that people don't know who to talk to about health and safety. They don't ask those questions because they think they just got to get the work done. And so if we're not going out and making that an issue about who to talk to about health and safety or where to go, we don't make it easier for young workers. We don't, and for new workers, we don't make it a focus. And I think we all need to do some of that, take on some of that, making people think about it. And because our employers will do whatever they have to do, we need to do what we need to do to look after each other. We are union. We are about collective action, about looking after each other. And it's the strength we have. And we need to bring that in every day to work, to talk about how we look after each other. And it just sometimes means telling people who to talk to and when to talk to somebody and why you need to talk to people. I think that's important.
I think one of the things that, that I certainly see in a lot of workplaces today that that certainly is going to probably even get worse, but we have a lot of young people entering the workforce with a lot of older workers leaving the workforce. And unfortunately, what we have is we have young people with very little experience training the next new worker coming into the workplace. And a lot of that institutional knowledge is leaving, and with a lot of young workers being trained by other young workers, I think, you know, to Michelle's point, we have to be really focused on getting our message about, you know, what you have to do to look after yourself on the workplace. Because unfortunately, employers don't do a good job of that. We all know that. We've experienced that. So yeah, as us as a union, we need to be better at getting that communication out to those young workers.
For sure.
Yeah, and we have a really good brochure and a program that USW partners with the Workers' Health and Safety Center in Ontario. Although the program is generic and can be used Canada-wide, it's available in French and English. The brochure is something that is really good. It's a two-pager. It talks about the right to know, the right to participate, the right to refuse. And then it also gives some basic information about the importance of training and who to report things to and where to find information about hazards in your workplace. And that is something that we are happy to share across the country. And it's one of the resources we give to new hires. And we also give these resources to high school students as well, and in our new member kits. And it's a program that, although we deliver it primarily in high schools or to new workers or new certs, we can certainly ensure that we try and make that information available in all of our workplaces. And we can even do little mini education sessions on that, because although it was designed specifically for the young workers, we changed our focus to make it for new workers as well, even new on the job. And the information in there is really important and can help save lives. One of the big things is training, and we can never have enough information. To Ed's point about the new workers coming into the workplace, losing a lot of seasoned, experienced workers, and the fact that there's a big gap there that we need to try and fill. Safety is going to be something that could be compromised if we don't do more there and spend more efforts in education and awareness.
Yeah. Back in the day, I remember that, Sylvie, you talked about the two-page brochure. We had a little pocket holder, pocket card with exactly the same kind of information on it, and people could put it in their shirt pockets and carry it with them and have it on them all the time.
Yeah, we still have those, John.
We call it an app now, don't we?
We use, yeah.
Yeah, everybody has an app.
Yeah, we do have them. And actually, we've developed some others, too, that are pocket cards that are specific to each jurisdiction that deal with the right to refuse unsafe work and giving them the outlines as to how to go about invoking that process. And we have workers' compensation cards so they know what to do in case they are injured at work, who to report and what to do. And we've recently just developed, it's my time to throw this in there, Scott, I hope. We developed a new resource about a mental health crisis call-in emergency number in Canada. And it's a 988 number. And we've developed these little cards too that are going to have QR codes on them. And basically it's for anyone can call this health crisis line, and they can talk about anything that relates to mental health, including suicide prevention. And they'll get to speak to live operators that are experienced and knowledgeable in mental health. And our brochure tells people when to call 911 versus when to call 988. And it's a little resource card as well. So those cards are really important, the ones you referred to, John, about the young workers and all the others, because they're easy to slip into a wallet, a lunch pail. And they're also available electronically. And we have a lot of young people now, and actually middle age, that are using technology more and more. And so we want to make things available and accessible electronically, and QR codes is another way that we can make that happen.
Yeah. Hey, I wanted to go, John, back to you, because Sylvia mentioned the rights, the worker rights, and I think that's what you want to talk about around Elliott Lake and the Ham Commission. So maybe that was a bit of a segue, because we've thrown out those, you know, right to know and right to participate and right to refuse. And so maybe you can tell us a bit about that.
So I was going to ask if people knew where those three rights, the right to know, the right to participate, and the right to refuse, where they actually came from. And a little known fact is that it was the local in Sault Ste. Marie at Algoma Steel that first negotiated it into their collective agreement. And from there, it picked up steam, and we picked it up in the mining sector in Sudbury and Elliott Lake. But it became law when it was enacted into the Ontario Occupational Health and Safety Act, which came out of the Ham Commission in 1976. And the Ham Commission came from what everybody calls the Wildcat Strike in Elliott Lake, which took place on April the 18th, 1974. At 2 o'clock in the afternoon, as I'd like to say. So the reason why the Wildcat Strike took place was Elliott Lake was a mining community, but more specifically, it was uranium mining. And it started in the mid-50s. By the time the 60s rolled around, the men were experiencing cases of cancer and silicosis and were being concerned about the work environment that they were being exposed to. They asked for help. They asked for studies. They asked for research. They wanted improvements. But the mining companies basically told them there's nothing wrong. Everything's fine. The air's good. They went to the governments, but the governments basically ignored them as well. But yet they still kept seeing an increase in cases of cancer and silicosis. So they began to take some steps and do a little bit of research on their own. But they weren't getting a lot of cooperation from anybody in particular. And so a lot of what they were getting was anecdotal information. In sometime around early April 1974, there was an international conference taking place in France where they were talking about uranium and radiation and that sort of thing. And the miners in Elliott Lake, the locals in Elliott Lake, decided that they were going to send a couple representatives to hear what was being said so that they could teach themselves a bit more about what they needed to do to better protect themselves. And what they found out was absolutely amazing in that the governments had told them no studies that were had taken place or needed. And yet here was the Ontario government presenting a report on this international stage about the studies that they had completed on the miners in Elliott Lake. And the results showed that they were dying at three times the rate of what was would have been expected in a normal population. Well, that incensed them. And when they went back to Elliott Lake and told the members what was going on and what had happened, bang, the wildcat took place immediately. They were at a membership meeting that afternoon, and they immediately called, they said, and they got the word to the underground. They got the word to the mills. They said, that's it. We're on strike. We're not going to put up with this bullshit any longer. And they got the media involved. They got the international, the district, the national offices of the Steelworkers Union involved. Homer Sagan was a very well-known health and safety expert in the day. He was out of Sudbury, and then he'd been assigned to Elliott Lake. Paul Falkowski was another member that Pittsburgh had sent in to help them. And they enlisted the help of the Ontario New Democratic Party. They got Stephen Lewis, who was the head of the party at the time, and they got Eli Martel, who was the occupational health and safety critic. They got them involved. And between them, they pressured the government of the day to put together the Ham Commission. And the companies had no choice but to comply and go along with it. And once we got that agreement in writing, and everything was said and done, the miners agreed to go back to work. The Ham Commission followed. There were 117 recommendations. And initially it was focused on just the mining industry, but the steelworkers and others said, look, every workplace in the province has health and safety hazards. You need to look at everything, not just mining. So that's why it eventually led to an act that protected all workplaces. But the kicker was that once the Occupational Health and Safety Act was enacted in 1979, the feds came into Elliott Lake and said, you don't have the protection of the Ontario Occupational Health and Safety Act. Uranium mines fall under federal regulations, so you're out of luck. You got to live with whatever regulations are in the federal laws. It took until 1984 for the unions to put enough pressure on the governments and the AECB at the time to finally enact law that said the uranium mines in Elliott Lake would receive the protections that were contained in the Ontario Occupational Health and Safety Act. So eventually they got what they had gone on strike for, but it took a hell of a long time. And from there, it flowed through the other provinces, and each one of them, one by one, started enacting their own occupational health and safety legislation. So Elliott Lake was a watershed, not in just the union's history, but also for working people, working women and men all over the country.
Thanks, John, for that. I knew a little bit about that, but that's a lot of information. And you know what? It excites me because there's so much about that story that shows what we can do as a union at so many levels. You know, there's direct member action. There's the locals working with other locals and the district and the international and solidarity. There's a global component to it. And then there's just the persistence of, you know, lobbying and legislative action and political action to get stuff done. And so, you know, it truly is a great story and a story of, you know, what we can achieve as union members and as a union to make real difference in people's
year,
lives.
Scott, yeah. It's going to be the 50th anniversary of Elliott Lake Wildcat Strike. And it's also a significant and notable consequence of historic value is that's where the Occupational Health and Safety Act, the Green Book, came as a result of that and then followed in every jurisdiction thereafter.
Yeah, for sure. So, Tyler, we're going to get this bad boy out before April 18th. At 2 p.m. because that is the so we can remind everyone that's the anniversary of the Wildcat strike. And I think that's great. And I don't want to not continue to talk about that, but we need to talk about a couple other anniversaries that are coming up. So
so let me give you a hook.
Here we go.
To move into the the West Rim.
Exactly.
Two people who were very involved in Elliott Lake, Clifford Frame and Colin Benner, became the main operators and superintendents of the West Rim Mine.
Really?
Oh, yeah. So absolutely.
Think about that again. There's the same
actors,
fucking assholes who are doing that in Elliott Lake. Yeah. I can swear I'm the director. Doing that in Elliott Lake went elsewhere, and I heard those characters were involved also
In the Yukon,
Giant Mine, right? Yeah. Like they were also involved at the Giant Mine.
So Colin Benner hates it, but we had nicknamed him years ago Dr. Death.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're responsible for killing workers all across Canada. And they just,
And the U.S.
And the U.S., yes. Yes. What a history. What a history to hold. Yeah. Right? What a legacy I get to hold on to.
Yeah, no kidding.
Not one that I want.
Which kind of leads us into our, we have our Stop the Killing campaign, which is ongoing, which flows out of the West Rim Mine disaster, which I think was mentioned already by one of you, Sylvia. I think that it's 32 years in May is the West Rim Mine disaster, and then it's 20 years, right? 20 years since the passing of the
Act.
March
31st.
Yeah, maybe somebody can chime in a little bit, Sylvia, if you want, a little bit about West Rim and those anniversaries coming up.
Yeah, so 32 years this May 9th will be since the West Rim Mine disaster took place. And we have regular annual observances and ceremonies for that. But specifically, we held a big one on the 30th anniversary. And we have wonderful video where on our website, which is really important for people to watch if they can, but hear the short clipping from Reverend Glenn Matheson, who presided over the service. And it was at the actual monument in Apictou, Nova Scotia, where the monument is a miner's lamp, and 13 rays of light come out on each side depicting the names of the miners who died. And the monument itself is also a tombstone because there's 11 bodies that still remain underground. And, I know Scott, you and many of you here on the podcast had been in past attendance at these events, but Reverend Glenn Matheson said, look around this park because there's 26 trees that were also planted in memory of each miner's life that was lost. The beauty of the park and the monument and the maintenance is because of USW and the support that we have given to the West Rim families groups over the years, and also the continuous fight for enforcement of the West Rim law, which was the lobby that led to enactment of the law. And that anniversary is coming up 20 years, this March 31st. And we're still on average having over 1,000 workers killed each year at work. And the law has been barely utilized. It's like been, only 9 successful prosecutions in like over 20 years. And that in itself is disgraceful when you think about it, because there's very few sentences. They're relatively minor. There's plea bargains. There's many that are dropped and criminal negligence charges are not applied. So our campaign has been calling for enforcement of the Westray Law, and we are calling for education and awareness and training for the police, Crown prosecutors, health and safety regulators, having dedicated prosecutors investigate workplace fatalities and critical injuries through a criminal lens. So this March 31st, we're going to be calling out the federal government. It's a federal law. It's administered provincially. And we're calling them out and asking them to do more, because we have the law in the books, but what good is the law if we're not utilizing it and enforcing it? So we're going to be asking for mandatory training for police, Crown prosecutors, health and safety regulators, and we're going to be asking for mandatory protocols and procedures in every jurisdiction across the country that's consistent. Right now, we don't have that. We have some memorandums of understanding with various police and ministries of labor and health and safety, or with specific police jurisdiction, but that can be wiped out at a stroke of a pen, and there's no consistency and continuity or direction that is mandated. So those are things that our campaign is going to be emphasizing, and we are revamping our campaign, and we're going to do everything that we've done in the past, target all levels of government and work with the police and the various community and labor organizations, and do more to hold up to the promise we made to the Westray families that we would push for this law to be utilized. And those responsible for enforcement would be told to do their job, investigate every workplace fatality through the criminal lens the way you do every other death in society.
That's great. Thanks for that. Thanks for that, Sylvia. And just usw.ca/e-thing stop the killing is where you can find out more about our campaign that Sylvia is talking about. I know Ed and Michelle, you've both been involved in that the campaign over the years. So I don't know if you had anything to add about Westray or the Stop the Killing.
I just want to say, I mean, I remember celebrating when in 2004 when the law came into place, and at the time we had a lawyer speaking to us at a conference I was at, and he said at the time, don't be too excited. The law's there. It's whether it gets used. And we didn't really get what he was talking about until we saw that it wasn't. And I also just want to say, what we know, what we all talk about, the Westray disaster, we don't call it an accident. And to John's point earlier, those people running that mine knew exactly what was wrong in there. And the people working there knew what was wrong and had no tools to fight it. That was not an accident. It was simply something that was going to happen and wasn't prevented. And that's the criminal part of it. And that is too often the case, that we have these issues building up that are known and are not stopped. And that's, if we don't start putting, I think Sylvia, to your point, I think there's only been one person who's done jail time on that law, and it wasn't very significant. And, you know, you cannot replace a life. You can't replace a life with money, and you can't replace it with pain, but you can force people to consider the consequences of doing evil when they know it's evil. And that's what we're trying to do with that campaign.
Well, and I think more often than not, I think the roadblock seems to be with the prosecution services throughout the provinces. I think a lot of times there's investigations done, very good investigations done by the police, and yet when the case is turned over to the prosecution services, it doesn't seem to progress. And there's so many examples of that. Just recently in BC, we've had that crane disaster in Kelowna in 2021. And so we've finally been told that the police have now sent that case to the prosecution service here in BC. And so we'll see where that progresses. But it is pretty obvious that there was negligence in that case. So it will be interesting to see where that progresses. I do think the focus there, though, is because there was a civilian, a person that wasn't at the work site that was killed. And I think that really made that a focus of a criminal investigation.
Yeah, that's unfortunate that it does take that. And you know, in BC, you know, even though that has happened with the Kelowna crane accident, we know there's been like three or four crane incidents that have happened just recently. And, you know, the deterrent factor of that happening quicker and the prosecution happening quicker, you know, might have prevented, like there was just a fatality last week at the big Oak Ridge construction site. And, you know, some of that might have been prevented if there had been quicker action and quicker prosecution.
A young woman with 21 years of age, a flagger at the job site, you know, with two young children was killed in that accident, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and one of the things that Michelle mentioned too about this is all preventable. And a lot of these deaths that we're referring to that do require the police to look at workplace fatalities through that criminal lens, clearly workers' lives are put at risk and they knowingly are doing it. Like Westray was what Justice Richard called a predictable path to disaster. They knew about all the violations that they were breaking under the Health and Safety Act, but they still pushed workers to work. They didn't care about workers' health and safety. And when we look at the enforcement issue, this is where the problem comes into play with the Westray law. And to Ed's point, the Crown prosecutors, when the police bring the information to them saying, we think this should be looked at through the criminal lens and there's potential criminality here, it's in the Crown's hands to determine whether or not they're going to prosecute. And they often look at whether or not there's a reasonable chance for a successful prosecution. Yeah. And, you know, what's been happening in the 20 years since the law was enacted, fines. There's lots of fines. They're very minimal fines. They're a slap on the wrist, a cost of doing business. And there is no cost to an individual life. But these fines are a write-off. They're a slap on the wrist. There's no deterrent whatsoever. So there has to be more. And if a few of them were thrown in jail and did serious time, had criminal records, they'd think twice about making sure health and safety is a priority and following the laws of the land. And when we think about the enforcement alone, it's 20 years now. This law has been on the books, and it's old, but it's not. It's in essence new. It takes the steelworkers to push the government to enforce the law and to do more. We have been educating them on a law that they are responsible for enforcing.
But the steelworkers are strong on pushing issues. I said this before about the gender thing. Steelworkers have been leading the way on women's health and safety in mining and elsewhere. But the Raise the Bar campaign, the Steelworkers Raise the Bar campaign, which is about women's health and safety, is an amazing campaign. And there's an amazing group of activist women within all different facets of industry that are represented by steelworkers that are creating this network to talk about the common issues and the individual issues, depending on where they work, and putting that lens on them. And I give so much credit to steelworkers. You know, steelworkers lead the way on a lot of these issues. As John said, they led the way on the right to refuse and the right to safe work. And they're leading the way again on with some of these women's health issues. They continue to do that. Steelworkers fought for the Westray Act, and steelworkers have fought to have the council and legislators and police forces educated on enforcing that act. And if it wasn't for steelworkers, that stuff would have fallen by the wayside. So, you know.
For sure. Thanks for raising that. Yeah. John, go ahead. Sorry.
I was going to say, I can remember the day, I'm aging myself, when women weren't allowed to go underground. And it was only when the Queen came to visit Canada that she wanted to go visit underground mine in Sudbury that the mining companies finally agreed to let a woman go underground, but they still wouldn't employ them. And it took a few years after that before the first women started showing up underground. And Sudbury had some of the first. Elliott Lake, I remember one woman, Carrie Chenier, who died not too long ago, who was a pioneer in Elliott Lake. She was the first woman to work underground. But when she got underground, there were absolutely no facilities for women. And when you're in an underground environment like the Elliott Lake mines, you go down by cage, which is a very rough elevator, and you can only go up at certain times. You can't just go up if you have to go to the washroom. So she was in a real pickle, if you will, whenever she had to, you know, go to the washroom, if you will. So we fought on her behalf eventually to get, you know, facilities so that she could take care of her body underground while she was underground. And it grew from there. But Nancy Hutchison was another one I know who was up in the mines in Northern Ontario. And I mean, it was rough to begin with, and it's still not pleasant today. You know that, Michelle.
Yep, I was a truck driver in the mine. And when I was actually up north in the Yukon or in the Northwest Territories, the law was still in place. We couldn't go underground. Yeah. That was in the 80s.
So, hey, we could talk all day with all of you about health and safety, I'm getting the flag that we gotta start to wrap it up. So I do want to say, usw.ca/raise the bar is where you can get more on the Raising the Bar campaign on our website. I just wanted to again, this year, on March 31st was the 20th anniversary of the Westray Act. April 18th at 2 p.m. Is the 50th anniversary. I know the 50s because I was born in the 70s, and so this is the 50th anniversary of the Wildcat at Elliott Lake. April 28th, of course, is the National Day of Mourning. That please look for events in your locals, in your communities, and May 9th is the 32nd anniversary of the Westray disaster. But I guess I want to thank everyone for being on, but I'm going to give you like 30 seconds each to close up. Really 30 seconds. I can see people laughing.
Scott,
it's not
can
a joke.
I jump in just, here then
and, just hang on. I'm going to give you 30 seconds to say what you want, but a thousand members or 1,000 workers a year are still killed in this country. This has been a bit of a somber kind of episode of the podcast because we're talking about people's lives, people's lives being lost and irreparably changed because of their work, which should never happen. But I want to give everyone a chance to say some closing comments. But you know, have we made some progress? I think we've made some progress, and I think there's some positives out there in the world of health and safety over the years. So maybe we can
having people like Michelle on the board.
Yeah, huh?
That's a change.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. Yeah, no, having worker reps on the workers' compensation boards is important.
Having NDP governments focusing Absolutely. On laws that work yes. for us too. But right. I still say, and in the workplace, the safety is the employer's responsibility, but we are each other's responsibility, and our symbol of those hands, don't forget that. Look to the person to the left of you and the person to the right of you and make sure they're okay every day.
I think as a steelworker, I'm proud of the history of our union because we have fought some very important fights and have been successful and will be successful going forward. So I'm proud to be a steelworker. I'm proud of all the things that we've accomplished and we will continue to accomplish. I do want to mention that we do have a conference coming up this year, the Health, Safety, and Justice Conference coming up in August. No, in September.
September.
So it's the inter.
It's October 2nd till 4th.
Oh, yeah. No, get it right. Yeah. I was thinking it's the International Health and Safety Conference in Pittsburgh is in August.
In August. Yeah.
But those are a couple of important events coming up for us for sure.
Okay.
And thank you to everyone for being here. Yeah. That's great.
Thanks, Ed. Sylvia?
Yeah.
30 seconds,
yeah, and
Sylvia.
I just wanted, I'm glad Ed brought up the conference. We do have our National Justice Conference October 2nd to 4th in Gatineau, Quebec. So we're hoping we get really good turnout and participation at that with a lot of our health and safety activists. And we will have topics on the agenda of raising the bar on women's health and safety, Elliot Lake's 50th anniversary, and the work that we've been doing in Stop the Killing, Enforce the Law campaign. And I can tell you that we have done a lot, Scott. We've made a lot of progress, and our union has so much to be proud of in what we've done since we embarked upon this Stop the Killing, Enforce the Law campaign. And there's still much work to be done, and we're going to continue to do that and continue to fight and engage our members and community organizations and others to ensure that the law is being enforced.
Thanks, Sylvia.
And let me just close out by saying that Scott, you mentioned there's thousands who are dying every year because of the workplace. I'd like to suggest that it's probably tens of thousands, because as Sylvia mentioned earlier, the thousand or so is those that are allowed by the different compensation boards across the province. But I know from my work in the past, the hidden diseases, the occupational illnesses are 10 to 1 of what we're seeing in the physical injuries and the recognized allowed occupational health claims. And I always like to put it in the context of occupational illness rather than occupational disease, because disease is a defined word in the Workers' Compensation Acts. An illness is not. An illness is broader in that context. There are so many exposures and toxins that workers are being hit with every single day that is impacting their bodies in one way or another and hurting them. And we don't know about it until years and years and years after the fact. And so if we talk about occupational illness, and we know that people are dying in significant numbers, far greater than what the boards are allowing. And that's where we need to put our work and our efforts and commit ourselves again on this April 28th to continue to do the work we've been doing, but do more of it.
That's great. And thanks, Sean. I really appreciate you. It's good to see you. At least virtually, and I really appreciate you taking the time. It was great to have you on. Great to have all of you on the Strongest Steel podcast on episode number 8. And I think I want to just encourage folks to continue to watch or continue to listen to the podcast on YouTube and the other Apple and the other podcasts. Programs that you can get podcasts on, share it, encourage other people to join the podcast. If you have any questions or issues or stuff you want us to raise on the podcast, you can email us at, okay, I always get this wrong, Brett, but I think it's d3comms@usw.ca. Again, d3comms@usw.ca. Thanks for listening. Thanks for watching. Thanks, Tyler, Brett, and thanks, Ed, Michelle, John, and Sylvia for being on. And I think, you know, there'll be some music. And thanks, everyone, for joining us.
Well, thank you.
Thanks.